Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Howard, thank you very much. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar for another exciting edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. I'm Patrick Evans. I'm joined by the Tonto to my Kemosabe, Randy Florence.
No, wait a minute. Tonto and Kemosabe were the... No, they weren't the same people.
No, they were not.
You were the Lone Ranger.
That, yes,
the
that's Kemosabe, what I was getting at. Yes.
And I'm Tonto.
That's right.
Can I go back? Can I be Trigger?
You want to be Trigger?
Yeah.
To my Roy Rogers?
You're Dale Evans.
I love Dale Evans.
Oh, God, I had such a crush on Dale Evans growing up.
I thought he was Lassie and brought his little mate with him.
Yeah. He's Timmy, and he's brought Lassie. We have Butters in the
Butters
house.
Butters is in the house.
Your brand new rescue. She's still a little shy.
She's still a little shy. We're trying to teach her that if Timmy goes into the to run to the house, scratch on the back door.
Tell us.
Yeah. Timmy. No, so we talked about Butters on the episode last week, and I had to bring her in. Nobody could see her.
She's absolutely adorable. She is so cute in all the pictures. This is the first time I got to meet her in person. She's even cuter in person, Butters. Yep. You're adorable. And she was very excited when John walked in because he is almost as furry as she is. So I think that's terrific. Today is actually our very first plant-based edition. Hank Plant is our guest. This is a gentleman.
That was so good. I'm like, where is he going with this? How long did you think about that? Did you come up with that just now?
It popped in my head when Hank walked in.
Wow.
I'm really excited. We've known each other for a few years. I mean,
since you started here on Chad 23 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah. Something like that.
Been a fan of yours that long.
I will tell you, it was one of the great compliments. We ran into each other and you said, and I knew, of course, who you were, and I've admired your work. And you were like, you do a great job. And that's coming from you. That was very high praise.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you.
I'm glad to be here. Congratulations to both of you on 3-year anniversary.
Thank you.
You were early in the podcast game, weren't you?
No, I think we were kind of late to the podcast.
Were you?
Everybody, but we're very gratified. We keep getting ranked, if such things matters, as one of the best podcasts in the Valley.
Wonderful.
And it's what I love about it is we keep getting really interesting guests.
I'll say.
Yeah, you said you really enjoyed Ron
Winter, Paul Feig you had on. Come on.
Yeah.
Because it was great.
Our next guest is going to be going, oh my God, you guys had Hank Plant.
I know.
Oh, really? I lost audio now in my hearing.
Hang on, we'll work on your audio.
Something. I can hear you over it, but I'm not getting it. I'm not getting it through the head. There it is.
There it is. Stop pressing buttons, John.
Yes.
John.
Amateur producer.
Well, is charged.
You did a little stint in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes. I'll tell you a little. I'll give you the 2-minute version of my life story. Sorry about my voice. I'm old and it's cracking. But so I grew up in the Midwest, Detroit area, blue collar family. And I came out of the 60s and I was part of that generation that wanted to change the world, make it a better place. And in those days, hard to believe, politics was the way to change the world, make it a better place. So there's a whole generation of us who moved to Washington, D.C. in the late 60s, early 70s. We were inspired by the Kennedy brothers, by Dr. King, and I thought I would work on Capitol Hill. So I applied for jobs on Capitol Hill. I was literally walking down the street in Washington, D.C., and I walked past the Washington Post. And
you needed to make some money.
I was broke. Yes, very good. And I was waiting to hear from these jobs, Capitol Hill. I thought maybe I could do something here for a while because it'd be interesting. I took the elevator up to the newsroom. I walked in. I'd never been in a newsroom before. it hit me like a wave. And Patrick, in those days, typewriters, so you had the sound of typewriters, the wire machines, police scanners, people shouting, paper. It was before computer paper moving everywhere.
Flying everywhere.
So those scenes from All the President's Men of real. The newsroom, they that were, was real.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely. And I just thought, this is the most exciting thing I've ever seen. I want to be here. So I bumped into the copy boys where they all sit. A copy boy and copy girl was like Jimmy Olsen. It's your lowest job in the newsroom. They sort the mail. They answer the phones. They do errands for the reporters. And I met the head copy boy. He said, I got an opening. He hired me. So dirt money. And I became a copy boy at the Washington Post. They liked me. They put me on the city desk. I worked for the city editors, answered the phones in the newsroom, helped reporters chase stories. I didn't know it, but I was learning from the best. Ben Bradley was the editor.
Yeah, that's a hell of a place to start.
I didn't know. I didn't know it wasn't always like this everywhere. Catherine Graham was the publisher. Carl Bernstein's working there. And so after a couple of years of that, working these grunt jobs, I went to one of the editors and I said, listen, I want to be a reporter. He said, well, you don't start here. There's a chain of newspapers, small papers out in the suburbs. And we sometimes hire reporters from there if they're any good. I know there's an opening there right now because we just hired a kid from there named Bob Woodward. Why don't you see if you can get his job? So I did, and I got that job. So Woodward came to the Post. I got his job. And I was trained by the same crusty old SOB who trained Bob and a bunch of other.
Every station had one of those, didn't they?
Honest to God, they really did.
Editors. A Lou Grant.
A Lou Grant, Randy. And because this guy would say, listen, I'm a slow learner. He would say, I'm going to beat this journalism into your head until you get it right. You miss the lead. You miss the story, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, not codependent. That word did not exist. So I became a newspaper reporter. Then I got jealous of all the TV people. I would go to cover stories, city council. I'd see these glamour boys and glamour women from television walk in, like Patrick with a nice suit, and a crew and cameras. It was like Ringling Brothers setting up this. And the mayor, they'd come down off the council. And they'd go over and say hi to the TV people. I'm sitting with all the newspaper people thinking, where are we in this? So I thought, I want to be a TV person. After a while, I got a job behind the scenes in D.C.
TTG?
TTG, yeah. Metro Media, I was the assignment editor. And then I got a job in radio in D.C. So I got over my initial mic fright. And then I got a job on air in Norfolk, Virginia, Patrick's home.
WBEC.
Yeah, ABC. Worked there for a year and a half.
I have many friends who went through that station. I was at the other end of the state. I was in Roanoke, Virginia, in Charlottesville.
Yeah, great station. And they were so nice to me. And I'll tell you what, I've always loved photographers, news photographers. And they taught me how to be a TV reporter. I knew how to do stories because I was a newspaper reporter, but I didn't know how to do video sound. It's a different way to put a story together and much more exciting. And the photographers taught me how to do video storytelling. I went to Minneapolis. Then I got a call out of the blue, come to Los Angeles.
Minneapolis was a pretty big market.
Loved Minneapolis. I think it was number 18.
Yeah.
I went to Los Angeles. I got lucky. I got a job there as an anchor and a reporter. And then I went to Houston to be an anchor for a couple years. And then I got my dream job, which was to come back to California to go to San Francisco. And I worked for KPIX, which is the CBS station, for 25 years, everything, anchoring, reporting, and then retired 16 years ago, and my husband and I moved to Palm Springs.
You were in San Francisco at a pretty amazing time, those 25 years. There weren't too many cities in the world that were going through all the stuff that city went through.
Yeah, there was a double. Dianne Feinstein sat me down when she was mayor, and she said, you got to realize that cities got hit with a double whammy at the same time in the early 80s, AIDS and homelessness. And it hit us all. We didn't have the budget for it. We didn't have the scientists for it.
And some of that was associated people ended up homeless because of health issues.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so there I was openly gay. I think I was the first openly gay TV reporter in the country. So I was in a good position in San Francisco to cover AIDS. They let me do it. I ran with it. It's like probably the work I'm proudest of because I was going on the air every night telling viewers, okay, here are the new drugs. This is what's working. This is what's not working. I was doing all the cases of discrimination, you name it. And I was covering AIDS, not full-time, but almost full-time for the years in the beginning, in the middle of the disease.
In the height of the AIDS crisis, it was a beat unto itself.
It was.
Ground zero.
It was. Yes. San Francisco was ground zero, Randy. We had more cases per capita than any city in the Western world. And remember, this was a time when the Reagan administration wasn't talking about it.
Yeah.
So the only information people had was if they lived in a place that had a responsible TV station or newspapers who were covering it. I stood in front of Ronald Reagan the night that he said the word AIDS for the first time. It was in 1987 in Washington, D.C. And when he said that word for the first time, and I made a note in my reporter's notebook, that was 6 years into the epidemic. And at that moment, when he said that word, 23,000 Americans had already died. So they did not do their job. But we were, I'm proud of it. We won a bunch of awards, a Peabody Award. And
yeah, you're a Peabody Award winner. And I don't know how many Emmys you have.
Six.
Six.
Thanks.
That's my job is to know those things.
All right.
So I want to go back to
Randy's our research department.
Yeah, okay.
I'm it. I want to go back to that because that was such an important time. KPIX took some heat early on for some of that reporting.
We did. We were called the AIDS Channel. Mm. There were people in our own building who didn't like that we were covering it so much, thought it would cost us viewers. We got a lot of hate calls. One woman called the news director right after one of my stories. I was interviewing some gay guy. And she said, there's one pervert interviewing another. And stuff like that. So even in San Francisco.
Even in San Francisco.
That was going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
That actually ended up with a documentary being made that you were a major part of.
Yeah, boy, this came out of the blue. About
Ward
5B.
5B, yeah. So the documentary film called 5B, as in boy, was being put together 6 years ago. And they called me and they said, we're doing this documentary. It was about the nurses who started Ward 5B, which at San Francisco General Hospital was the first AIDS ward in the nation. And we heard about it. We want to do a documentary about it. We want you to be part of it. And because you were the guy who covered it. And I said, yes. So they flew down here and interviewed me. And I didn't know that there was huge money behind it. Johnson & Johnson had paid for it. And they hired one of the top PR firms in Los Angeles, Rogers & Cowan, to promote it. And this thing got nominated and was accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. And they called me up on a Thursday and said, can you go to France on Sunday? And do you own a tuxedo? And I said, yes and yes. And we went to the Cannes Film Festival. We won first place out of 850 entries. I got this award at Hallmark from the Cannes Film Festival.
That is crazy.
And I'm very proud of that. And I'm very proud. I got to spend almost a year with these nurses flying around the country promoting this film. They were just so wonderful. And they were doing this work, caring for AIDS patients, when we didn't know how this thing was being spread.
Right.
They didn't know if they were bringing it home to their kids and their spouses. And they just showed up and did their work. These people are saints.
You talked at one time about the fact that the majority of friends that you had back then aren't here anymore.
And I'm not a lot of gay men my age. I've lost most or all of their friends. And it's interesting. I talked about this in the movie, actually, that I think that we have all suffered a kind of PTSD that we buried and we have not had a national conversation about. You don't lose all your friends in your 20s and not have it scar you. And I think we buried it. We left. We went to Palm Springs. We moved to nice little towns to get away from all the memories and the ghosts. But it's down there.
It's there.
It's there. It's there. It comes up. I was sitting in the Cannes Film Festival watching this, watching the movie, right? It's the second time I had seen it. I saw it the first time when they had a small premiere in San Francisco, but the official premiere was at Cannes. So I'm sitting there in a tuxedo crying my eyes out. The whole thing just hit.
Yeah.
I didn't cry the first time I saw it, but for some reason I was just able to let go and relax and get into it. And I was sitting next to the one of the women nurses who kicked into nurse mode and held my hand and had me a handkerchief. But
so how did you personally report through all of this? This was a personal thing?
Very personal.
But it was something that had to get out. How did you wake up in the morning and say, this is what I'm going to do today?
Because I had a purpose. And I didn't just wallow in my grief and in my anger about it. I was in a position to channel the grief and the anger into the stories. And it was very gratifying for me to put lawyers on camera who were shafting and representing insurance companies. I chased lawyers down the hall with cameras rolling.
And I always wondered, why would they sit across from you?
Yeah, my husband asked me that. Why, knowing you, why do they agree to be interviewed?
Were going to be the first person that got the best of Hank?
Well, think that, first of all, people love being on television and they want to get their side out, but they didn't know that I'm the kind of reporter who does his homework. I would never look at what I brought in.
You did more research as a guest than we've ever done as hosts.
I want to have my facts right in case we talk about politics or whatever.
Uh-oh. We're supposed to have our facts right on this show.
Oh, no.
That's what Bruce Fessy always tells us. He's mad at us.
Yeah, it's true. Oh.
But so it was a channel for, it was a way for me to channel my grief, and I felt like I was making a difference.
And that goes back to what you said at the very beginning. You're a product of the 60s. You moved to Washington, D.C. because you wanted to make a difference.
Yeah.
And then channeling that in your journalism career, and especially a topic that was, A, very personal to you.
Yes.
That you were very close to and that you were so extremely knowledgeable about. It's a perfect storm. It's a terrible place to be, but a really good place to be as a journalist.
It is. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more gratifying than putting the bad guys on camera.
Yeah.
Whether it's public officials who aren't doing anything, or whether it's a landlord who's kicking out gay people because they might have AIDS, it's very gratifying. And so instead of me going home and complaining about it to my husband, I can get it. It's like it's free therapy. I can get it all
out. How long have you, and your husband's Roger?
Yes.
How long have you and Roger been together?
Almost 32 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And he's an artist.
He's an artist. He's a
remarkably talented artist.
He's very talented, and he's a very interesting guy. He was art director at Gap headquarters. So he did all that. Remember when Old Navy started?
No.
And all of their graphics, like the old trucks and that old time, so very Palm Springs. A lot of that was his hand illustrations. He did everything from billboards in Times Square to he designed right field at the Giants ballpark in San Francisco.
Wow.
Because when the water cannons.
The brick wall
and the water cannons that shoot up, that's all him. Because the Old Navy leased that.
Yeah.
And they said, we got to do something with it. And so that's all his. So he does all kinds of stuff. Yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah.
I got to go to a Giants game now. I'm thinking about the park again. Well, it's been too long.
Oh, it's a wonderful park.
That's the best park in the country.
And listen, I sat and played it all because now he had all these tickets. We went to opening day. I took my mother. She couldn't believe it. It was great.
That's phenomenal.
Opening day of the park.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was great.
Was it Pac Bell?
It was Pac Bell.
It opened, yeah.
It's only had 15 different names.
It's a great place to see a ball game.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I love that ballpark.
I want to go back, and we'll get back to some more cheerier things to discuss here, but I want to go back to that short period of time when you first started reporting on the AIDS epidemic at San Francisco. KPIX gets known as the AIDS channel.
That's right.
Did you have any challenges as you went forward from there interviewing politicians or anybody else that didn't necessarily want to be interviewed by the gentleman who's leading the AIDS?
No.
Okay, good.
I've had plenty of politicians who didn't want to be interviewed.
But it had nothing to do with AIDS.
Not because of AIDS. Yeah.
Yeah. With five different presidents you've interviewed?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who is your favorite?
Well, now see, when you ask a reporter that,
the favorite,
he's going to tell you, he's not going to see. What you are asking is, who did I like?
That is, that's exactly what I'm asking.
But the reporter's answer is, who's the most interesting? And I always go with, what's the interesting story? So it's hard to beat Richard Nixon.
All right.
So I liked that. The one I liked the most was Obama. That guy was just all hard. Yeah. She's just so loving and genuine and compassionate. He's hard to beat. Clinton was the smartest, I think. Who I really liked was George W. Bush. I didn't agree with his politics at all. I think he completely broke the Middle East and crashed the economy.
Yeah.
But you couldn't meet a nicer guy. And I asked him the rudest question. I saved it till the end of the interview. But
which is what you do. You have to.
You wait till the end, but I'm always respectful. But I said to him on camera, I said, listen, I need to ask you this question, and I don't mean any disrespect by it. So he braced himself. And I said, there are people who think you're not bright enough to be president. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and just stared at me. There was like uncomfortable silence. And I said, well, what do you say to them? And he said, I would say to them, come down to Texas and see what kind of a job we've done there and blah, blah, blah. So then the interview ended and I thought, okay, here we go. Camera's off. Here we go. He said, hang on. I want to talk to you. And so he said to his Secret Service detail, give me a minute with this guy. And my photographer left. And you know what? He just schmoozed. He just said, tell me about yourself. Tell me about San Francisco. Tell me about this market. Tell me about Silicon Valley, because I need to know about Silicon Valley. I know you cover that. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And he wasn't trying to kiss up to me. Interview was over, but he was genuinely interested. He had a reporter who I think at that point, maybe he respected me, because I asked him that. He answered it fine.
Tough questions.
And he knew that he had to make inroads into Silicon Valley, which was starting to really boom at that point. And how do you walk away from that and not admire the guy? So anyway, that's a long answer to your question.
Well, I liked it.
And I love
it's always really interesting.
The wife had a sense of humor that never came through. I was interviewing her.
Laura Bush.
I was interviewing her one time, different occasion, at the Four Seasons Hotel. They were in San Francisco. They were when she was first lady. They were setting up the lights and the camera, and so we had to make small talk. And I said, how do you like the hotel? She said, oh, it's great. And I said, this is one of those hotels where the top floors are condo. And if you buy a condo, you have the full hotel services. You just pick up the phone. You want a car. You want dinner. You want theater tickets. She said, oh, we have that at the White House. I thought, this is the funniest person I've ever met. I really loved her from that moment. And none of that ever came through.
She never came across. She was not particularly high profile.
No, but a sense of humor.
And that was only the second most important press conference out of Four Seasons. As I seem to recall.
What was the other one? What am I missing?
I seem to recall Giuliani in front of.
Hair was melting?
No, that was a Four Seasons. What a good memory.
It was a Four Seasons something like that.
That's right.
Oh my goodness. And that's a master. Yeah,
the hair died. It's running down.
That's a good memory.
We've had the pleasure of having Barbara Boxer on as a guest.
Yes.
And I'm sure that you guys cross paths.
I'm in her book?
Yeah.
I embarrassed her. I'm in her book. It was during the Clinton scandal with Monica Lewinsky. And it just broke. The Lewinsky thing just broke. And I had to go get a soundbite with her. And she was with a bunch of elementary school children outdoors in a park. And I walked up to her and I asked her about the stain on Monica's dress in front of the school children. I don't know. I wasn't thinking. She put it in her book.
Yes. How did she respond?
She said, Hank, can we talk about it not in front of the school children? Anyway. Yeah.
What was the first story that you remember doing that you thought this was important?
When I was a newspaper reporter at this small chain of papers, I got a tip that this was in Washington, D.C. suburbs, that Alan Dulles, the former head of the CIA,
the man responsible for killing Kennedy.
So, I'm not going there.
Next episode.
I'm not going there. And Richard Helms, at that point, the deputy director of the CIA under Alan Dulles. We're seeing the same psychiatrist on alternate days, and they each of them didn't know they were seeing the same shrink. And
wow.
I said, now, how do I break that? I got a tip. The shrink said it at a party. So I had the shrink's name, and I said, I got to break this one. So I said, the only way to do it, it's got to come from the shrink. It's got to come from the shrink. I can't call Alan Dulles up, and I think he was dead at that point. Richard Helms, at that point, I think was director of the CIA. I'm not calling him up. So I called the shrink. His name was Corcoran. And there's a reporting trick that I learned. I never used it before, which is skip the first question. Don't ask him if it's true or not. Go into it assuming that you both know it's true and ask the second question. So I was so nervous. I remember I was in my apartment. It was on a Saturday. I was calling from. I was so nervous sitting in it. I remember where I was sitting and everything in the apartment. I called this guy up. I had his number. And I introduced myself, and we did a little chatting. And I said, I heard that great story about how Richard Helms and Alan Dulles were both seeing you on alternate days. But then the schedule got mixed up, and they bumped into each other in your waiting room. What was that like? Tell me about that. He said they were absolutely fine. They had a good laugh over it. I know it sounds like something was right out of the movies, like The President's Analyst or one of those old James Coburn movies, but it was just fine. And so there was nothing that came out of it that was bad.
So he admitted it right off the
bat. He admitted it.
He walked him right past the opportunity to say, no, it's not true.
That was one of the reporters.
That's a brilliant reporter trick.
It really is. I'll tell you a second one that I learned this from Bob Woodward. And Woodward learned it from the CIA, and I've used it many times, and if I weren't retired, I wouldn't share it with you, which is you ask a question, you wait for them to answer, they answer, and then you go silent, and you just look at them. It's extremely uncomfortable, and so they start talking again, and that's when they invariably tell the truth. And I've used it so many times, especially on camera. And the camera's rolling and rolling and rolling, and it's silent and silent. You have to train yourself to not give
anything. That's got
to
be hard.
Not give anything. You just sit there and no judgment. No judgment in your face. You sit there and you just look at them. And they will invariably start talking again.
They will feel compelled to fill the silence.
That's the CIA expression. The truth will fill the silence.
Oh, no.
Woodward got it from the CIA, and I got it from Woodward.
That's amazing.
The truth will fill the silence.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's so cool.
Yep.
I had a sales manager one time tell me that if anybody ever started yelling at me on the phone, that I was to start talking and halfway through my sentence, just hang up. Because nobody would ever think you're hanging up on yourself. And when I don't call back, it's because I thought you hung up on me.
That's really good. That's so really good.
If I ever hang up on you, you'll know what I'm doing.
That's right. Okay.
Call me back.
Yeah.
You've talked to, during that 25-year period at KPIX, some of the biggest personalities in the world, political. Where was there ever a time where you walked into an interview and you were reticent or hesitant or nervous about walking into that interview?
I get nervous a lot.
Do you?
Oh, sure. It's intimidating. President, you got the whole scene of Secret Service and clearance. And guys with guns and president. So, yeah, nervous is fine. It's a good motivator and keeps me on my toes, gets my brain working. No problem with nervous. I will tell you the most intimidated I've ever been on a story, and it had a very good ending. Steve Jobs, I'll tell you the end of the story. I wound up interviewing Steve Jobs, and it was an exclusive. And he didn't do many interviews. But to back up, Steve Jobs had been fired from Apple. He went off into the wilderness. He came up with a new computer of his own. Next, you're really good.
Well, I lived in the Bay Area.
You're really good. And Steve Jobs called a press conference to unveil Next. Okay, this was a huge deal. This was his big baby after being in the wilderness for 2 or 3 years. He rented Davies Symphony Hall. to unveil next. People flew in from all over the world, press, and everybody from the tech industry was there. They filled that hall. And they put out the word, no interviews, but you can cover it, you can shoot it. So I'm in the back with my photographer, along with zillions of other photographers and press people. I was scared to death because his press conference started at about 2 p.m. And I had to be live at 5 in front of that hall and do the story, what this was about. And I know nothing about computers. And in the Bay Area, it's full of smart people, including people in the computer business. In fact, one of the challenges being a reporter in a place like San Francisco is you got 3 Nobel Prize winners watching, and they've won their prize in whatever I'm talking about that night, retroviruses or God knows what. And they call.
They'll call.
They call. All right. So I was scared to death, but I figure I'm going to pay really close attention. I told the photographer, roll on everything. I'll watch your time code over your shoulder. We're not going to have a lot of time to turn this room. We're going to be live in 5. It's already 2:00. So Steve Jobs is up on stage, a football field away from it, giving his presentation. Larry, photographer, is rolling. He's talking and talking, and I realize I don't understand a word he's saying. I don't understand a word he's saying, and I've got to go on TV in 2.5 hours, and I don't know what to do. And he finishes. He finishes. I don't have a soundbite. I don't have 12 seconds. I got nothing. I said to Larry, I'm in trouble. We got to get him. Larry said, you're going to get him. This is like a rock concert. You see those 3 guys on either side of the edge of the stage? You ain't getting up there. So I said, let's try. Take the camera off your tripod. Put it down at your waist. I got a stick mic, wireless. I'll hold it at my side. Let's just walk through the crowd. So we walk through the crowd. Everybody's leaving. Walk up to the side of the stage. We get up. And Steve's up on stage being greeted by all these other techies and his fans and stuff. We get up the stage. I'm on the stage. As soon as I get up onto the stage, these 3 security guys move in on me. Steve Jobs turns around and he sees me and he gives me the look that, Patrick, you have seen 100 times, and that is, they know you from TV. Where do I know that guy? You know that look?
Yeah.
He gave me the look. He knew me.
And you knew you had that moment.
I had it because he waved me through. Oh. He waved me through. And I thought, Christ, he may not know my name, but he knows me from TV. He waved me through. And I thought, I'm in. So we walked up to him. I was honest with him. I figured, don't BS a guy like Steve Jobs.
I don't understand a word.
I don't know anything you just said.
But nice. And I got to put a story on in less than 3 hours.
Please tell me in your best layperson's term what this computer does. He gave it to me. But no, first he looked at Larry and he said, are you rolling? Which...
He's very awesome. Savvy. I mean, he's a smart guy, but he's
smart
savvy
guy,
too.
Are you rolling? And Larry said, yes, of course. And so I said, what's it do? He gives me a couple of sound bites. I said, thank you so much. So we walked out. On the way out, I had to do some other interviews. I bumped into Todd Rundgren, the musician,
who was
a computer genius. He was one of the first musicians to use computers in his music. So I figured, there's a nice man in the crowd to interview. So he gave me a quick bite, and I fed it back in front. All my bosses saw was, oh my God, it's an exclusive. That's our mic play. With Steve, nobody's got a... I got a still photo on my wall at home here in Palm Springs of me interviewing Steve Jobs. And I look like a genius. I can't tell you to this day what Next Computers does. But when it came time for me to do my live shot, I said, blah, 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 500 people here. And instead of me telling you what this thing does, we got an exclusive interview from the man himself. Throw to the soundbite, back to me live. See you, back to you at 6.
Wow. That's remarkable.
So that's a long answer to...
Which one?
What intimidated me, and it had a happy ending.
There's a 6 degrees of separation here that I just recalled. So Next Computers, they're... One of their major clients for Steve Jobs, and this was a big deal in Silicon Valley, was a real estate company named after the guy who started it, Alain Pinel.
Oh.
And Alain Pinel now lives here in the Valley.
Is that right?
He sold that real estate company. The computer thing was a bomb.
Oh.
It was a few years early for real estate people to start using it.
Yeah.
But that's how they were making their bones in town, was buying Next computers from Steve Jobs.
Interesting.
Yeah. Do you ever run into a Lon Pinnell down here?
I have not.
You've never. I used to see editorials from him talking about how this area would be much better if it was more like Silicon Valley.
Oh.
Well, okay. Sure.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know. Wow. Yeah. Every time there's a major political story, I look at your feed because you usually have a picture with the person who
made the headlines.
And usually also a really cool little anecdote.
Oh, yeah.
And it's always amazing to me, especially I know that you interviewed Gavin Newsom a great deal.
Many times, yeah. I've known all the Gavin Newsoms.
Yes.
Yeah.
I sat in a restaurant in San Francisco about 2 weeks after some unfortunate news broke about his marriage in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And he was sitting alone in the corner of this restaurant, eating dinner by himself. And it was about the saddest picture I'd ever seen in my life.
Was he mayor at the time?
He was mayor.
Mayor of San Francisco.
Is this about the affair that he had or about the divorce? Oh, the affair. Yeah. He gave me the exclusive interview on that after the affair. I worked him for weeks and his family. It's the best interview he's ever done.
Really?
Yes. I also did the worst interview he's ever done.
Tell me about that.
The worst interview was... He ran for governor the first time, and then Jerry Brown got in the race, and it became clear that nobody was going to get that nomination except Jerry Brown. And Gavin became pouty Gavin, and he disappeared. He was the mayor. He disappeared for 3 days. Nobody knew where the mayor was, even his staff. As it turns out, he was in a bad mood. He was mad because he wasn't going to be governor. And he flew to Hawaii for a break. And so then he came back and he had to start talking to the press, and the city budget had come up. So he had scheduled a series of one-on-one interviews about the city budget. There were several reporters lined up to do these one-on-ones with him. So I walked in with two cameras and interviewed him, and he thought I was going to ask about the budget. But I said, where have you been and what makes you think you could leave town as mayor of one of the biggest cities in the world and not tell anybody? And he said, I'm here to talk about the budget. And I said, no. And this became the worst interview he's ever done.
He got combative with
you? This is on YouTube. If you Google Gavin Newsom, Hank Plant, testy interview.
I've seen it.
It got a lot of play. And I know of two political consultants right now who are still using that video to show their clients how to not do an interview. He, at the end of the interview, got up very huffy, took the mic off, looked at me, walking out of the room saying, I'm very disappointed in you. But what he didn't know was my photographer was rolling on the whole thing. And we put it all on TV. And he didn't talk to me for weeks after that.
Oh, yeah. How did you repair that? Eventually has to talk to
you. Yeah, I was going to say, did you need to repair it?
Well, we all need each other, and it got repaired when he decided to run for lieutenant governor, and he needed all of us. I've seen him since then, and I've spent an hour with him, actually, when he was running for re-election as governor. Since then, the relationship isn't the same, because I knew him before he was even mayor, but that's fine.
You still had to do your job.
Well, we have to do our job.
Your job is to ask the tough questions. You're going to piss people off.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I'm proud of that. But I'll tell you what. I do think that first interview where he talked about having the affair, his own consultant told me that's the best interview he's ever done. And it was all, people don't understand when they're being interviewed. That story can go any way they want it to. They are in total control of how they come across, and it's based on their attitude.
Can you give us an example of somebody you interviewed where you felt at the end that they controlled the direction?
Willie Brown, who is the smartest person I've ever known in politics, who was the former assembly speaker, and the mayor of San Francisco, always in a good mood and always smiling, and consequently rarely had a bad interview. Arnold Schwarzenegger was always, I loved covering him as governor, he had a big life before Gumby.
Yeah.
Okay, let's,
yeah.
come on, let's. And so he didn't get caught up in the pettiness of it, and he was always bigger than the story. He said something about, he had a lot of things that went wrong, they all do. Oh, he got a ticket. He was riding in a motorcycle with a sidecar with his kid. He didn't have a license for it. He got ticketed for it. And it became an embarrassment. And I asked him about it. And he wound up saying, wasn't that great? Wasn't that great? He got all that publicity. Wasn't that great? Now, how do you, what do you
that's
say
fantastic.
To that? What do you say to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that pretty much say, ends things right there.
Yeah. 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 So, not a controversy anymore.
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
The personalities, you mentioned Willie Brown, and that just made me think about the personalities around San Francisco during the time that you were there, the governors that were in the state at that time, these were big personalities,
the mayors
of San Francisco.
You are so on target. Yeah. I got to cover it. Come on, Willie Brown, Dianne Feinstein, Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Big personality. You got it. I was so lucky. There's nobody like that out there right now.
Yeah.
You look at these candidates we have running for governor, and I'm not disparaging them. There's no personality, even among the eight Democrats and even among the two Republicans who are look like they're going to be in the runoff, I mean, in the primary. So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
That had to make things... It'd be fairly exciting knowing every day when I wake up, I'm going to get to talk to somebody that...
It made news easy. I'll tell you what, if someone like Willie Brown is mayor and it's a dull news day, all I had to do was grab a photographer, go down to City Hall, stick a mic in his face, and I'd have a lead story.
You'd get
a...
He'd
come up, I think we should build a third Bay Bridge or something, or I think we should tear down City Hall. And
there was always a...
Something.
There was always a story about Willie making it from San Francisco to Sacramento in an hour and a half or something.
Oh, and he said, yes, and he said on camera, the state police patrol that, and I carry their legislators. Just like that. He said it.
Oh, and he drove like these ungodly cars that went 200 miles an hour.
Willie said, I said to him, why don't you own a house? He said, if I can't eat it, wear it, or drive it, I don't want to own it. Willie was actually...
I missed the Bay Area back then.
Oh, it was heaven. I said to him once, why don't you email? Why don't you ever email? He said, because the E stands for evidence. He says these things on camera.
He's just a walking soundbite. Oh my gosh, that is gold.
It's Can you imagine being a reporter?
yeah. Tell us a little bit, Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
There's a lot of misunderstanding of Nancy from people who don't like her.
Yeah.
Tell us what your experiences with Nancy were.
She is a Catholic mother of five. They love to paint her as this wild-eyed progressive Democrat from San Francisco. She's not. She's liberal on social issues, but personally, she's very buttoned up. Her father, I've known her since before she was elected office.
Right.
Her father was the mayor of Baltimore, legendary mayor of Baltimore, Tommy D'Alessandro. And little Nancy's job was to stand next to her father with a notepad. This is how she learned politics. And when people would come to see Mayor D'Alessandro to ask for favors, Nancy's job was to write down the favor. And so she was the keeper of the favors for her father.
Wow.
That's how she learned,
politics. In politics.
She told me her father taught her. So her father, she said to me, my father taught me, never let the smile go out of your voice. But she's one of those ones who, you talk about being quiet on the phone, negotiating, never raises her voice. And so I liked her very much. She was a brilliant fundraiser. She raised $2 billion for the Democrats since she was in office, which I think first was 88. She was first elected to Congress. Very effective, probably the most powerful woman in the history of American politics. Got a lot of legislation passed, including Obamacare, which helps a lot of people. And I'll tell you what, this will tell you a lot about her. When you're first elected, the new Congress is seated and the new members get 90 seconds, because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
You get 90 seconds, walk to the front, say something into the microphone, Usually they thank their family or whatever. She got up. She was the first elected, and I think I'm right, the year was 88. Walked to the front, stood in front of the microphone, said, "My name is Nancy Pelosi, and I'm here to fight AIDS." And wow. Went and sat down. And so she was very clear why the voters of San Francisco sent her there. And she used one of her staff positions to hire a guy named Dr. Steve Moran, and his job was AIDS. The science, the politics, all, they don't get that many staff positions.
Yeah.
And one of them she assigned, this is your job, fight it.
So the fight wouldn't have taken place without Nancy Pelosi doing what she was
doing. No, it would not. And also Willie and also Mayor Feinstein, there was a time, I did stories on this, there was a time in the 80s when Mayor Dianne Feinstein's AIDS budget for the city of San Francisco was bigger than President Reagan's AIDS budget was for the entire nation. And that was true for 2 years in a row, and that was because of Feinstein and Willie Brown, who was the assembly leader at that point, and Nancy Pelosi, who was a new member of Congress. Feinstein was another one who was very prudish. When AIDS first came along, she had a staff meeting in her mayor's office, and she had to ask her gay staff members in this meeting, "All right, I guess you better tell me what goes on in these gay bathhouses." And they did. They did. And half
she
the room,
blushed.
She, half the room blushed. Yeah. And the joke after that, with domestic partners, the legislation came up, and the joke in the gay community was, I guess Diane must think domestic partners is a house cleaning service. She doesn't know anything.
That's so scary.
But you didn't stop her. Didn't stop her.
Was there an interview that you had to do a single person that was consistently difficult for you?
Jerry Falwell was always a pain.
What a surprise.
For a man of God, I thought, especially, he's so hateful. And I never liked interviewing him, but it was a chance for me to ask the question that the viewers wanted. When I was working as a reporter, and Patrick, you might feel this, I think you probably do, I always had to anticipate, what are the viewers' questions? Not so much what does Hank want, but what's important to these people? So you got to think, okay, they care about their tax dollars, schools, kids, public safety, healthcare, that kind of thing. So even though I may want to talk about my commute, when are you going to fix the road I'm driving on? I always try to anticipate what the viewer's questions. Not sure how I go off on that, but I had to do the job of the viewers interviewing someone like Falwell or somebody like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you, when you did something like that, how did you form the questions? When you wanted to put yourself in the position of asking the viewers questions and looking at a person like Falwell?
First of all, when you work as a reporter, you really are in touch with the zeitgeist in the community. You get a sense of how people are feeling because people stop you on the street. Cab drivers, Uber drivers, they tell you what's on their mind when they see your reporter. And so you get a pretty good sense of what the public mood is, for one. And two is, there's no substitute for homework. If I'm going into an interview with someone like Falwell, I'm going to be armed with facts. And I'm probably going to read interviews that he's done so I know how he's going to answer certain questions. And I'll be ready with the response. I don't wing it on an important interview like that.
He brought research to our podcast.
Well, I know, but if you
notice I slid mine away here.
You mentioned you were likely the first openly gay television reporter. When did you... Were you always out as a television reporter, or was it, because it was still a pretty delicate time when you first started?
Yeah, but I say that because I was out as a newspaper reporter. So when I got to TV, I was already out. So my first on-air job was 1978 in Norfolk, and I was out. Yeah.
Did it ever create an issue for you?
Many times. When I got hired to be the main anchor in Houston. Now, we're not talking California, we're talking Houston, Texas.
Pretty big difference.
All right. The general The news director was a fan of mine, and I had worked with him before. And so he wanted me to be the main anchor. He let me know the general manager of the station did not like the fact that his anchorman was going to be openly gay. But he let the news director build his team. He didn't want to veto the news director's choice. And I met with that general manager, and it was like ice was in the room. And I tried to be charming, but I figured, he's not going to like me, fine. I'll cash my check anyway. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
I want to do this job, and so all that. When I left that station, he called me in, and he said, I was wrong about you. Now, it helps that the ratings were better than he ever expected.
That does help.
Than I ever expected. But I see that as a real defining moment, and I'm not saying it to brag. I'm saying it because I think we can change people's minds. The way to get over homophobia is just to spend time around gay people. I think when the state Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage, that was a big story.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that the Chief Justice at the time, Ron George, was a Republican. He had gotten to know the gay couple in his apartment building. And that changed, and I don't know that he ever knew gay people as friends before. And I know for a fact that weighed his decision about treating gay people equally. They're just like us, kind of thing. And so that's how you change people's minds.
Yeah. It's hard to turn somebody into a monster when they're standing right in front of you and you see them and you like them.
Yeah.
Your role has changed in retirement. Yeah, obviously, you were an incredible reporter and very fair, and whatever biases we all take into our job, reporters are really good at not showing those, and the best ones don't show any, and that was you. But in your retirement now, do you consider yourself more of an activist?
Not an activist, but I like writing opinion columns. I don't have an axe to grind. It's just that I've learned a little bit, and it's a chance now to tell you my opinion for whatever it's worth.
Which is something you never did.
No, I couldn't.
You couldn't, right?
I couldn't. I had to be extra careful. If I was covering the gay parade, I had to be careful not to do a walking stand-up. I didn't want to look like I was marching, even though I was openly gay. Anytime I did a gay story, I had to be extra careful. And I don't know what it's like for Jewish reporters covering the Middle East, for example. I have a hunch that they feel maybe some extra pressure to be fair and to look fair. So now it's very free. I make wisecracks on Facebook that I could never
run. They're pretty good.
It must be very free.
It's liberating to be able to do that. It's a good word, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hank, I read in an interview that you said one time, I watched journalism in the 1970s become cool. How would you bookend that now in 2026?
Oh, it's a heartbreak.
Yeah.
It's an absolute heartbreak. And what's happening with the right-wing takeover of CBS, and now I shudder to see what's going to happen to CNN. Again, you remember who the investors are, the Ellisons. The Saudis, and they're not going to put up with CNN. They're just not. So I don't know what we're in for, but it's a heartbreak, and the viewer is the ultimate loser.
Where do you get your news?
I read, first of all, I don't overdose on it.
Yeah.
I subscribe to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I look at them. I read a lot in those papers. The Desert Sun. I love the Palm Springs Post.
Yeah.
I think that all the growth in journalism is hyper-local because they're covering what's going on. And what the kind of stories they're covering probably has more impact on your life than what's happening in Sacramento or Washington. And I watch Anderson Cooper for about the first 15 minutes, and I'll watch the first 15 minutes of a network newscast. I think ABC has the best reporters right now, and I'll watch ABC most nights for the top of the book. I don't care about the feature stories at the end.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point if there's an opinion communicated, I don't want it.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm not on Twitter much. Or go ahead.
I always tell kids in their undies, no matter what you're watching, as soon as you hear the phrase, "And now we turn to our panel," your news is done.
Yeah. Right.
Now all you're going to get is conflicting opinions.
That's right.
Any fact-based reporting has to stop.
And the public doesn't realize that panel, they're not journalists.
No, most of them.
But you think because they're on CNN or MS or even Fox that they're journalists. They're not. They're people giving their opinions. So, yeah.
So blurred the line with these cable broadcasts.
Yeah, it's what you're in one camp or the other. I think CNN still does a pretty good job in the middle on most things. When I hear people say, why does Trump get so much negative coverage? My answer is because he does negative things. They're covering what he does. Where do you start?
I'm fascinated by the person that you became in terms of a journalist, the ability to be able to ask the hard questions, to look at somebody in the eyes and get to the bottom of what you... Where did that all come from with
that
you,
Hank? That came from being openly gay. I know that's a strange answer,
no?
But I will tell you, one of the lessons I've learned in life is once you've slain your demons, the rest of life gets easier.
Wow.
The other thing that happened is I quit drinking and doing other things.
It was the 80s in San Francisco.
It was the 70s when I quit drinking 48 years ago.
Wow.
Congratulations. And that, thank you. And that changed me 100% and gave me confidence. And so those two things gave me the confidence to be who I am and to not be afraid and to ask tougher questions.
Yeah.
And to learn how to do it respectfully.
That was certainly my experience in watching you for all those years up in the Bay Area. And I've told you this privately. I want to say it publicly. My mother would be so excited that I am sitting here talking to Hank Plant.
Thank you.
You were a hero of hers.
That's great to hear. My mother would love to hear that.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you. Yeah.
We've been wanting to have you on, so I'm so glad we did. And it was worth the wait.
This is a real pleasure. I just loved it. And so thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We keep trying to tell people if they want to listen to the important people in this valley, this is the show they need to be listening to.
You're right.
And this will probably be the episode that proves it.
we'll
got there 150 others.
We'll see. Yeah.
Hey, thanks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to spend time with you.
But
this is, I think, the first chance we've really had to sit down and have this kind of conversation.
Yeah, you're right.
And I so enjoy it.
Thanks, you too.
Pretty good for Butter's first episode.
Butter's did a fantastic job. She's brilliant as the mascot of our podcast.
She's the smartest member of my family.
We want to thank Hank Plant, our guest. Randy, fantastic job. John McMullen, thank you. I'm Patrick Evans. Thanks to the team here at Skip's Little Bar. They always treat us like we're family, meaning that they are ready for us to leave at any moment.
3 days.
And we thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday. Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all. Conversations, little bar, and big conversations, little bar.